Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a 25-year retired prosecutor from Savannah, Chatham County, Georgia. Murder cases conjure all manner of images when we hear about them. Most of us have some level of sympathetic reaction for the victims, from at least some sorrow for the sudden loss of life, to physical revulsion at the injuries inflicted. Gathering and presenting evidence of homicides requires investigators and medical professionals to put their feelings away, at least temporarily, in order to be thorough in documenting the evidence and in running down all leads. Autopsy evidence, which describes the cause and manner of a murder victim's death, is critical evidence in every murder case that can be hard to look at or listen to. For many years in Savannah, our chief medical examiner was Dr. Jamie Downs, a nationally renowned forensic pathologist. Dr. Downs conducted the autopsy of Lauren Brown Smart and enabled the jury to understand the excruciating pain Lauren experienced in the last minutes of her life. This may be difficult for listeners. At trial, Dr. Downs described what Norman Smart did to Lauren as overkill. This episode explores why.
Experience. So why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, I'm Jamie Downs, a forensic pathologist.
And you are a forensic pathologist. What are you doing these days?
Oh, I am doing a little bit of everything. I am a jack of all trades. So my Monday gig is I'm medical director for the physician assistant program at Charleston Southern University in my hometown, Charleston, South Carolina. And the rest of the week, I find myself doing all sorts of things. Part-time pinch hitting for the Charleston County Coroner's Office as one of the forensic pathologists there. So if they have need for autopsies to be done, I conduct those for them. I do the same thing for Gwinnett County, Georgia, which is Lawrenceville. And really my main thing that I'm spending most of my time doing is consulting on cases from really all over the place.
Well, and you have enormous background in forensic pathology. And I always ask you this, like when I have you on the stand, but you know, a lot of people don't have any idea what forensic pathologists do. They think you're like a coroner, and that is not anywhere close to what you actually do. So can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I'll give your listeners a real easy way to tell the difference. A coroner is a politician. I don't think there is any way that anyone will ever confuse me for being a politician.
With you there.
So, basically, coroner actually comes to us. We inherited it from Old England, and it goes to the waybacks. The office existed to investigate deaths, and there were basically something like circuit court judges that would actually travel. And so the coroner would go around from jurisdiction to jurisdiction to investigate any fatalities that happened. And there were a lot of constraints that were placed on people that found dead bodies. They literally had to raise the hue and cry. You've heard that term before. So it made me go back to that. But what happened was it kind of fell by the wayside. And then Richard the Lionhearted, who turned out wasn't quite so, was kidnapped and held hostage on the River Rhine. England needed to pay the bail, so they did. They got him back, but then they needed to put money back into the coffers. So what they ended up doing was reinvigorating this antiquated office, and the Crown basically got money. So one of the things that is a holdover from that whole origin to today is the stigma of suicide. Nobody wants their family member to have committed suicide. Well, one of the reasons is that the Crown got to keep all the property, because if you committed suicide, then all your property was forfeited to the Crown. Again, the Crown needed to raise money. So that's what happened. Same thing happened in homicides, by the way. So it'd be interesting, I guess, if you had a suicide or a homicide, say, that involved a horse, the Crown gets your horse.
Wow. Wow. I mean, that's actually some history I didn't know. Now, you and I, like I said, you have been a forensic pathologist for how long now?
I think it's 33 years.
Wow. And I know that I go through this with you all the time. What does it take to be a forensic pathologist?
Okay. Let me unpack that a little bit, because a lot of people don't understand. It's another thing that's related to what a coroner is. They think that coroners are medical experts, and they might be, but in most of the country, because the term coroner means different things in different places. So I'll stick to Georgia, but in Georgia, your qualifications to be coroner are you're 18 and registered to vote. That's it.
Wow.
You too can be a coroner. Now, they do have to go through an extensive training period once they get the job. I think it's 40 hours. And then they have to do continuing education hours. And I'm not trying to disparage coroners. I've known and worked with some great ones. I've also worked with some forensic pathologists who, let's just say, maybe weren't so good. But your question was, what is a forensic pathologist? Well, a forensic pathologist is first and foremost a physician. So I went to medical school. I actually went in Charleston. That's my hometown. So I did my training at the Medical University of South Carolina. Then you do a residency after medical school. So for me, that was 5 years in anatomic pathology and clinical pathology. And so let me break down what that is, because that is, you know, leads right to another question. Pathology is a specialty of medicine that uses the laboratory to study disease. All right, there are two big branches. You heard me use the word anatomic and clinical. Anatomic is pertaining to the tissues in the body. So an example would be you have your appendix taken out. The anatomic pathologist would get that tissue sample, look at it under the microscope, and tell you what was wrong with it, why it needed to come out. If something untoward happened and that patient were to die, then the family could consent, request for an anatomic pathologist to perform an autopsy. Now, that is done, like I said, by request, which means the family decides the extent of the examination. They can say you only get to examine the left big toe. And I would be bound by that request. I could only examine that left big toe. So there are some limits there, and it's expensive. Believe it or not, the autopsy pathology is the only field that's not reimbursed by the federal government.
What?
So, yes, you heard that right. So autopsies that are performed at hospitals, unless they make other arrangements to get reimbursed from the family directly, those doctors are not getting paid to do the autopsy.
Which is why they wouldn't want to.
Well, they don't want to because oftentimes in hospitals, and I think you probably have been to some autopsy facilities, perhaps locally, they're usually tucked away in places that aren't so nice, not so well lit, and perhaps don't smell so good. So it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So it takes a huge amount of time. They're not getting paid to do it. And really, honestly, in fairness, they're not really that well trained at it. Because in order to leave your forensic anatomic pathology training program, I think when I went through, you had to do 50 autopsies in 5 years, which for me would be a busy month.
I was going to say, you've done way more than that in a single year.
Yeah. So you can see, and actually in some training programs, I'm told that they aren't getting autopsies done because the autopsy rate in hospitals is going down. So the training, the students in training will actually share bodies. So what they will do is one will do the head, the brain examination, and the other will do the rest of the body. Yeah, it's I don't understand it. I'm not a fan of something like that. But anyway, so that's anatomic pathology in a nutshell.
Wow.
Clinical pathology is the laboratory part. So that would be the doctor that runs the lab that says, well, your white count is elevated. You have this kind of bacteria growing in your belly or in your blood. So forensic pathology generally best takes those two different branches, merges them together, and applies them to cases of sudden, unnatural, unexpected death and or injury. But here's the thing. Not every forensic pathologist also trained in clinical pathology. So clinical pathology is very long process, and quite honestly, a lot of people can find it very boring because you're just looking at numbers and instrumentation. But it's critically important, and I actually was taught by Joe Davis, who was one of the great names in the history of forensic pathology in the U.S. He told me that I had to do both. He really didn't give me an option, and I'm so grateful to Joe for doing that.
Well, it seems like it's a more holistic approach to do both because you get to see all of the things that could influence a death.
Well, sure, and you understand things. For instance, I have a patient with, say, there's a toxicology question. All right, well, the forensic pathologist who is trained in anatomic pathology, yeah, they can look at that and they can get the report about the numbers. But as a clinical pathologist, I know how those numbers are generated. I know how the instruments work, and I know where there might be flaws in the system. So I think I can do a better job of understanding things. In addition, I have taken everything I learned in lab medicine and applied it in terms of quality control, in terms of analyzing a case and the forensic analysis of a case. So all those different reports that come from all the techs and all the labs, I can take that and understand it and apply it because you have different levels of people that are working in different labs. You have people that maybe they've got a bachelor's in chemistry and they call themselves a forensic toxicologist. Well, that's okay unless you think that forensic toxicologists are doctorate level people in chemistry and have that level of expertise. So I think it's misleading to equate those two. I think they're significantly different.
I'm going to jump in here just for a second, because on my end, you know, as a prosecutor, it was very important to me to have somebody that could testify that had expertise. Like, you know, this case, and I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at Lauren Smart's case. I know, you know, I kind of contacted you out of the blue on this, but there was a suspicion that Lauren was drunk and that, you know, she had fallen and all those kinds of things. There are things that you, because of both sides of it, both sides of the equation here, would know what the effects on her body would have been. Like, you know, if she'd had a couple of things of vodka in a certain amount of time, how that would have affected her. Would she have been falling down drunk? Those kinds of things, which a forensic toxicologist can only give you the average.
Well, it depends on what kind of forensic toxicologist you're talking about. If you've got somebody who's trained to run instruments and give you numbers, and I actually had this happen in a different jurisdiction. I had someone who was a bachelor's in chemistry, called themselves a forensic toxicologist, and were qualified in court to testify as such. And they started talking about the effects of alcohol to contradict my opinions about the cause of the effects of alcohol, which there's not, I have no problem with someone who's qualified rendering those opinions, but the key word there is qualified. When you have someone who really isn't qualified to speak about the facts, period, they really shouldn't be contradicting someone who is qualified and has years of experience. And so that's why I think we need to be very careful in understanding the qualifications of the people that are doing the work. And yes, it's very important when you're trying to understand everything, what happened to Ms. Fart, part of it is related to, you know, was she drinking? But then there's another part I can't speak to, which is if she were drinking, what that was all about. And that's better posed to somebody perhaps in the field of forensic psychiatry or something like that. I can tell you that oftentimes you have people that are in a domestic violence situation that do drink to kind of numb the pain. But I can only speak in those generalities. I can't speak about any individual particularly.
Right. And it, you know, we're going to get into Lauren and her murder soon. But I do want to cover a couple of other things with you, because I think that there was some suspicion early on if she was just drunk and she fell, and you know, that's where the bruising came from. But that clearly was not the case, and thank goodness you saw that.
Well, actually, it's funny because the initial history that I was presented with is that, yeah, she had some bruises, but words to the effect of she was a fallen down drunk. And I remember when the case came in, I was presented with that information. I was also very busy the day that the case call came in. And I really didn't have time to do the exam that day, but I also know that time is a friend to the investigator. So if I can get answers to them quickly, it improves their investigation. So I went ahead and did a very quick external examination. I did see some bruises, and they were in places that might be okay for somebody who was an alcoholic. That is, you've heard the term falling down drunk. And it is just that. People who get drunk fall down, they hit their knees, their forearms, their shins, their elbows. Sometimes they fall and break their wrist. That's a very common injury with a fall. But they turn their hands to break the fall. So there are certain patterns of injuries that I look for in doing a physical exam. One of the things that concerned me in this case was I saw petechial hemorrhages, which are pinpoint hemorrhages in the whites of the eyes. Now, that can occur in many different types of death, oftentimes in cardiac deaths. And probably folks have heard about that most often in strangulation cases. And yes, they're very common in strangulation. But here's the thing. They don't have to be there in order for it to be a strangulation. And the presence of them doesn't mean that it is a strangulation. So a good forensic pathologist is going to look at all the information and render an opinion and not base it on this finding or that finding in isolation. So I'm doing this partial examination, trying to give the cops information. I see the petechial hemorrhages and I say, guys, this case is going to require more time. I'm a little bit concerned right now.
Yeah. And as I recall, it took a couple of days to complete this autopsy, if I remember right.
That's usually the way my life works. I think that you do a better job when you're not rushed. And the thing is, if you are distracted by other motives, if your office is interested in other things, or interested in moving paper, then that puts the forensic pathologist in a bad situation. It's not about just getting reports out as quickly as you can. What you want is the right answer, number one.
Right.
And if you have a report, you want a report that while it might be challenged, there won't be any legitimate basis for the challenge. It's kind of funny. I remember being criticized once for an autopsy report that was too long at 25 pages. And it was a child abuse case. And I might have said something to the individual that was chastising me for this lengthy dissertation. I believe I said something to the effect, I'll be sure to tell the next child that's abused to death not to have so many injuries.
Yeah, it's one of those situations that I'm laughing and you know that I have a morbid sense of humor, but it's not funny at all.
No, it's horrible. But that was the point I was actually making. You know, I have a dry sense of humor. it was to point out how silly that comment was, and shame on the person who said it, who really that's just completely inappropriate to say something like that. And of course, when it went to trial, which it did, they did get a conviction. And the DA who prosecuted it said it was the best autopsy report he'd ever written or ever seen. Cut that back and we'll do that again. So they trial and they did get a conviction, and the DA who prosecuted it told me that it was the best autopsy report he'd ever seen. And I told him, while I appreciated his saying that, that wasn't what it was about. It was about getting justice, and you know, justice doesn't have a side.
Right. The evidence is the evidence, and it's there or it's not there, and we don't make it up. I think that that's one of those things that I've started this podcast. Well, that's part of it, is that we get accused, prosecutors and you know, people who have worked in forensic pathology or any forensic medium, that get called by the state, get accused of fabricating things. And that's not the business that we're in.
Your ethical canons say you can't take a case to trial unless you have a reasonable belief you're going to get a conviction. That's kind of very sobering. But I'll also tell you something that amazed me, and I had just kind of, I guess, not even thought about it because I've heard it for so long. But my wife was accompanying me into the courtroom. I think it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I had just left the state, and one of the security guards who was retired from the sheriff's office said, "Oh, Doc, you're working for the dark side now." And everybody, yeah, and it's that kind of humor where you go, "Ha ha, isn't that cute?" But no, it's not cute. That's not funny at all. If you don't have good qualified people working for the defense, who is going to work for the defense? Because they are innocent until proven guilty. My brother-in-law is the public defender in Charleston County, South Carolina. He is honestly the singularly most ethical person I've ever met. He is incredible. I have seen him in cases. He's had to defend the undefendable.
Sure.
He's done it with grace and professionalism and has seen it through to the end. And he actually cares so much about his clients that when they get out, he works with them in halfway houses and tries to get them a new start. So to tell me that that's the dark side, if that's your idea of the dark side, I think you might need to reevaluate what your priorities are.
Understood. And one of the things we didn't talk about, and you raised this issue when you were talking about the autopsy report that was praised, you have some remarkable areas of very specific expertise, and you've written all kinds of treatises and parts of standard books and things like that. When you mentioned that it was a child abuse case, all I could think is, oh, didn't you write a chapter on shaken baby syndrome? I mean, am I wrong about that?
Shaken baby syndrome. You got me. You can get me wound up, and maybe you'll do it.
I'm here for hours, days.
But no, if you're interested in that subject, first of all, that term has fallen out of favor. It's like, if you don't like something, let's rebrand it and it'll be okay. We worked for years to get people to understand that you actually could kill a child or severely injure a child with your bare hands just by the process of this accelerating, decelerating the body. And some of your listeners may have heard of the junk science of shaken baby syndrome. And there's actually a book out about it and a paper, Shaken Baby Syndrome, The Next Innocence Project. And what they're trying to do is get overturned by calling it junk science. And what I've seen from all of the cases that I've looked at is the junk science is by people that are twisting things, unbelievably twisting things, and trying to present as reality their fantasies about investigations and what papers mean. And that's just, it's almost that the people have gone in this quest and they get, it's a cognitive bias. They believe this doesn't exist. Therefore, anything they see, anything they read, they discount. And one of the things that amazes me, there's a famous paper by a fellow who since passed on, about falls off of playground equipment that ended in death. And this paper is fascinating to me because, number one, they're not falls. I don't think being projected or launched off a swing set is equivalent to falling off a couch. Forgive me, I just don't think that those are the same thing. Being swirled around on one of those twirly wheels and then launched into the air off of that, I don't think is the same as falling off a bed. And yet they're presented as the same. And then the few cases that were published in this, I think there were 12 out of 70,000 cases investigated, only two were actually applicable and could be looked at. There was one that actually mentions a videotape. And for years and years, everybody's talked about this videotaped fall off one of those plastic, like 2 foot high plastic slides. Well, if you actually have seen the video, which, gosh, he had the video, I think he could have inserted stills from that video into his paper to help enlighten us. You will see that the child isn't a simple fall. He's twisting, or she is twisting, and gets her neck bent back. So this is not a simple fall, and I'm not exactly sure about the extent of the autopsy, if any one was conducted, because some of these cases weren't even autopsied.
Whoa!
So that's basing all of this on what you want to have happened rather than fact. So when people start pounding their fists and talking about science, which I had happened in a child abuse case last month, very famous neuropathologist came down to Texas where I was, and he had these photomicrographs, which are pictures that are taken under a microscope and blown up. And he had these things, and he turned around and slid them over the table at me when we were meeting with the defense attorneys. And he says, there you go. There's the cause of death. It's pneumonia. And I looked at him, and I said to my friend, because he is a friend and still is, that's not the cause of death. That's insufficient to have killed this child. What killed this child was the massive brain injuries and the 20 impacts to the head. Well, his response is, there's only one impact to the head. He saw what he wanted to see. And then he had to like discount or ignore the other impacts to the head. And yeah, I mean, that's what happens in these kind of cases. And then a lot of people get animosity and start screaming at each other. And like I said, the guy remains my friend. He just happened to be wrong in this case.
Right. You know, it is a really complex area. And of course, I have worked with you. I've worked with other scientific experts and people who are well-trained in forensic work. And I don't know that I've ever worked with anybody that ever wanted to make something up or fudge or discount or any of those things. So I'm astounded when I see or hear stuff like that. It amazes me.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been doing this for quite a while, as have you. And maybe people don't realize it's a lot of work to do cases. Why on earth would anybody want to do all of this extensive work when there's not a case? It just makes no sense. And yet that's what they project onto us.
Exactly. Like we want to, we're going and looking for work to do. We always had work to do. Always, always. So I want to talk about Lauren and you know, some of your very specific expertise and you know, things like tool marks and those kinds of things came up in this case. But you already mentioned that you saw these petechial hemorrhages. There were some other allegations that had been made that she died from anorexia or died from, you know, like some sort of internal injury that wasn't related to the incident that killed her. What do you recall seeing? You did this external examination, and you know, people don't understand how autopsies work. How does the autopsy work for you?
All right, well, there's two big parts. There's an external exam and an internal exam. External is the longest part of the exam because what's the biggest organ in the body? The skin. And so a good autopsy is going to go head to toe, looking at detail and looking at whatever happens to be there and documenting that thoroughly with photographs, measurements, and really is to the point that someone else, like me, can come along a year, 2 years, 5 years later, look at my description, look at my photographs, and render their own opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty. And that's my job, is to make it so someone else can come behind me and do quality control or formulate their own opinion. They may not agree with me, but they ought to at least be able to see how I got to the opinion that I had.
And you take your own pictures for the most part.
I definitely try to. I can tell you that when I take the pictures, they're going to be better. They're going to be properly framed. They're going to be in focus. The subject is going to be concentration of the picture rather than just pointing a camera. One of my pet peeves is people who just put it on automatic and think that's the way a camera works. And yeah, automatic settings can be really good. Photo snobs would call them an idiot setting, because all of those little things, the little twisty wheels and dials and things that have an A and an M and a P, and you know, then there's that plus minus wheel. All of those things, all of those tools are designed to allow you to take a better picture. And nowadays you have this wonderful stuff called metadata that resides in all those images. So I can look at metadata, and I've done this before, and said, wait a minute, gee, they said they did this case here, but this picture has metadata from 2 days later. I look at this case and go, wow, this black gentleman has really, really lightened skin. All the pictures are washed out because they had taken the exposure compensation and twisted it to make the picture, to force it to be lighter.
I'm kind of lost. Why would you do that?
Well, I can't speak to other people's intent. Oh, gee, that's another thing. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not the court. So I don't do intent. That's not a medical construct. That's a legal construct. So I can't tell you why somebody did. I can only tell you that they did. I can tell you why I might use it on occasion, but I would also take another picture with it uncompensated so that you could see the difference. And that is, let's say you've got somebody who has really dark skin and has a bruise that's hard to see.
Right.
Okay. That would make sense. I could see doing that. I don't know why other people do it in a particular case, but you know, it's like we, especially with pictures, and I've actually tried to explain this to other people that work in the office, because the forensic pathologist isn't the lone person. There are investigators. The state of Georgia actually doesn't have death investigators. They have death investigation specialists who basically, they are middle people between the coroner, who's an actual investigator, and the pathologist. So what they are is a secretary who takes the information from the coroner and then provides that to the pathologist. So they aren't investigating cases. They don't have any training in investigations. They don't investigate. Some people use them to take pictures. And I tried to explain to them, hey, you know, it's kind of like being an artist. I can't teach you how to be an artist. I can give you the tool. I can give you a camera. I can explain the settings to you. but I can't make you understand what I see.
Right. So in this instance, and you obviously, you had a lot to document as far as the external and the internal with this. Did you, before you got started, did you have information from the crime scene itself, or was that stuff you got later? By information, I'm talking about just like pictures or information from the detectives. I'm not talking about the physical stuff because that came in later as well.
Yeah, no. When this case started, like I said, it came in as we think this lady basically was a fallen down drunk. And what I remember in terms of the information when it first came in is that she was an alcoholic. They believed that she had fallen down to account for injuries on her extremities. And that was pretty much it. It was based on the history, I believe, that I was like, well, I don't know why these guys are like so hot to have this body examined right now, but I'm certainly happy to do it for them because there was some concern about it. I do know that. So that's why I stopped doing the other exam when I finished that and then turned to do that quick external on her.
Well, and I can explain part of that. Obviously, I talked to the detectives, but there was a conflict between the detectives. One group thought it was a nothing and one group thought it was a something. And I'm really grateful that you took the time and looked.
Well, I, you know, again, that's my job is to try to help where I can. And the pathologist should always be there to try to be a resource for the investigators, because they're the ones actually at the scene. And, you know, the best kind of scene is when the pathologist can go to the scene. And that's the way I trained, was to be a scene pathologist. Unfortunately, given the realities of the jurisdiction at GBI, that just doesn't work that way. There's too big a territory. Having said that, from time to time, the cops would call me to scenes in Savannah. I'd be happy to go. They'd call me in other counties, and I'd be less happy to go, but I'd go. So, because that's how I cut my teeth. I'm a scene pathologist, and my function at the scene is to try to help the people there gain important information. And again, as quickly as possible, because time is an asset. Adequate time is an asset, a tool that the investigators can use.
Right. And we were actually very lucky in this case. The forensics officer, the main forensics officer that responded was Michelle Chiron. I don't know if you remember Michelle.
I remember her quite well. So go ahead and finish what you're going to tell me about Michelle. And then I'll tell you what you may not know about Michelle.
Well, I interviewed her for this. So we're going to have, we've got good people. I'm very excited. But I love Michelle, and she is an incredibly talented forensics investigator. But, you know, we have talked about you a little bit, but you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I thought you were going to say, and she's just a great forensics officer, which is kind of where I thought you were going with that. But I would like to say part of that, I think, that why she's a good forensics investigator is I was working with the National Forensic Academy at the time. And they called me and said, hey, Jamie, we've got an opening. Do you have anyone who can come? We had one person had to drop from our class at the last minute. This is like a week before classes start. And it was a 12-week program, something like that. Well, I said, well, let me see what I can do. And, of course, I had worked with Michelle before. So I called her up and asked if she'd be interested. And then my next call was to the chief, because I wanted to get the slot filled. And I believe if you got to have a decision made, you get the decision maker. You don't need to go through a whole bunch of other people. Well, sometimes that's not so good for the other people. They may not appreciate basically being circumvented. But again, I only had a week to try to get somebody. And so she ended up going to that training program. And I think it was a great benefit for the people of Savannah.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And she's still out there doing it. She's working for Chatham County PD right now. And just fabulous, in my opinion.
Well, I can tell you, as a contrast, I remember one case when I first got there, a lady was outside. It was an ugly case. She had been stabbed multiple times. And one of the forensic people on that scene made comment about having to look for the pillow. And I was kind of puzzled by that. The pillow, what do you mean? Well, the pillow that was involved with her stabbing, because she's got these pieces of pillow foam all around her. He was looking at fly eggs. And this is somebody who had years of experience who didn't understand the difference between fly eggs, which are important evidence. They can be to some people, like me.
Yeah, a level of decomp, you know, things.
Yeah, well, you might be familiar with a case where they weren't so considered so important. Let me put it that way.
I'm familiar with a couple, actually, but yeah, I wish we could have great people all the time. But this is one of those cases where I had great people.
That's the thing, is when you've got a good team and they work well together. The problem comes when you have limits put in the way of by people who maybe have other things on their plate.
Right. Right. And you know, all of us end up with situations like that. But thank goodness, you know, this is one of those cases where we had good all around. And you mentioned stabbing. Stabbings to me, and often domestic cases involve stabbing as well. You get that sensory visceral feeling of how awful it is to die this way. I got that feeling from Lauren's autopsy and the work you did here.
I would say this type in particular, maybe even more so than stabbing, because this was multiple blunt force. This was strangulation. This was an attack that went on a long period of time. And you just hope at some point she became unconscious and didn't have to experience it.
Right. Right. And, you know, I remember your testimony. I remember preparing for this case. And I remember the very first time I saw the autopsy pictures in this case. And I've seen a lot of autopsy pictures. This one really got under my skin. I don't mean that ironically. It's really disturbing to see what happened to her. And I was trying to go through, I've got the transcripts from the trial. I was trying to go through. I remember an enormous number of injuries, external and internal, on Lauren's body. And I was trying to figure out if we ever summarized it. We probably did at the end, and I'm not at the end. So I don't know if you remember.
Conservatively, I'm going to say probably like 100.
That sounds right. I'll scan through here just to see while we're talking. But you did in the external, you started photographing it. There were some injuries that stood out, I think. There's a really obvious one that I kind of want to get to almost last, because you did such a unique and wonderful job presenting that evidence. But there were some injuries to her face. There were injuries to her mouth, just her neck, all kinds of injuries that were indicative of a really horrific experience for her. Can you talk about those?
Sure. She was clearly, based on the facial injury, she was smacked around. She was beaten, punched, slapped, whatever. I can't be more specific than that. Interestingly, they weren't more damaging than they were. So she was beat up, but not to the point where, you know, it broke the skin or anything like that. She was strangled. She had some blunt force to her neck. So all of this would be painful. And again, I can't speak to the psychology of the person doing it, but very common type of things in domestic violence situations. So those things, yeah. But then as I kept going with the exam, I noticed there was a big cluster of bruises on the center of her chest, bruises to her arms and to her legs especially. So the ones that stood out to me were the big cluster on the chest and on the knees. I believe there was also one on her left hip. And I started looking at those wounds. And you mentioned earlier, just for clarification purposes, you mentioned that I had experience in tool marks. Well, I do have experience in terms of having cases that involve that, but I'm not a tool mark examiner. What I do is...
I have to say pattern injury, sorry.
And I just wanted to be clear because you know me, it's like I'm going to try to tell you the truth as best I can. I don't want to over-represent. I don't want to overstate things. So what I do is pattern injuries. I've written some stuff on it and published some stuff on it. But pattern injuries are things that leave a pattern. So, for example, walking on the beach, you see a footprint on the beach. Now, you know what caused that footprint on the beach. You don't need to see the foot make it, say, oh, a foot caused that. Well, a pattern injury is the same thing. You see a footprint on the body, which is kind of an interesting analogy, and we'll sure come to that in a few. But you see a footprint on the body, and you go, oh, there's a foot that caused that. I can see that. So, and the same thing is true. I had a case I mentioned earlier going to scenes. I had a case when I was in Mobile, and a fellow had these hexagonal injuries on the side of his head. And I said, I don't know what caused this, but when we find the weapon, I'm going to be able to tell you that's the weapon or something that looked just like it. Well, as it turns out, we had all seen the weapon because it was hanging on the wall because the assailant had taken down a pair of bolt cutters, beaten his roommate with the bolt cutters, and then cleaned it and hung it back on the wall. So we had all walked right by it. But the key to me was the detail of this hexagonal pattern that repeated. So I saw multiple of these overlapping hexagonal things. I had another case when I was working at in Savannah. Fellow was found underneath a pickup truck camper top. And he had a blood blister on his finger, and he had some marks on his neck. And in looking at things, it took me a while. He also had multiple lacerations on his head. And I was able to get the weapon, which turned out to be a pair of channel lock pliers. Well, I'm a home handyman and worked maintenance when I was in college and high school. So I'm familiar with tools. I've seen a lot of tools.
It
definitely helps. Experience your whole life helps you in my line of work. Well, the channel lock pliers, I was able to, you know, match them to the head injuries and things like that. But then I started looking at the neck, and I realized that there was this very fine pattern of about 6 parallel lines that were maybe 3/8 of an inch long, and that line pattern repeated. And then there were pairs of little dots that were one end of some of those parallel lines. And if you look, open up a pair of channel lock pliers and look at the two parts of the plier, yeah, they're the little grippy parts that are inside, and the two dots were where it was pivoted and dug into the skin. Oh, and the blood blister, that's where he grabs the channel lock pliers and it pinched his finger as he's trying to get the assailant off his neck. So it's basically combining experience in recognizing a pattern and then looking at all the injuries in toto. And, you know, I have been blessed with the ability to do that. I don't really understand. I mean, I can see it. So to me, it's obvious. And it's like, why can't everybody see this? But we all have different skills and abilities. And God blessed me with the ability to see these things for a reason. So, heck, I want to take the gift.
Sure. And you've done an amazing job over the years explaining what you see. And I think, you know, all of the things that you've already talked about, the photographing it yourself, all of those things help to clarify things when you're talking to a jury that wasn't there, that doesn't understand the work that you do. It can make an enormous difference. And, you know, I could go on and on. And I think that it's one of those things that people in the prosecution field do a disservice by not sitting down and talking to you and understanding how
That's one of my big pet peeves.
I know.
In fact, you may have heard the last time I went to trial, I had zero prep time. I was asked, which pictures do you want to use? And I had happened, for my purposes only, to print out in black and white close-ups of the wounds and a copy of the x-ray. And the prosecutor said, oh, well, I didn't pull this x-ray. So they took my black and white bad printout, and that was it. That was the prep for going to testify. And this was a different prosecutor because the case had already been tried once and was back for a retrial, but they had no knowledge about anything that I might have revised an opinion on. I wasn't asked if that. It was like, okay, well, you're here and you're going to go testify, and that was it.
Right.
And that's a disservice to the people.
Right. And it's a disservice to everybody, really. I'm jumping in. I know that, and I'm sorry, but this is one of those things I feel really, really strongly about. Because when you have a case, and my understanding is that there was a claim of self-defense in that case,
yes,
there are things that you as a forensic pathologist can rule out based on what you see as far as the injuries. You can also render opinions as to, is this consistent? Is this scenario consistent with the injuries you see? And if no one's talked to you, how do you have that conversation? How do you testify? Oh,
absolutely. You may remember, in fact, I'm sure you do, you probably were prosecuting it with Jerry Rothschild, the Thunderbolt case.
No, that actually was Maggie DeLeon. And she has recently left the district attorney's office. But Jerry, as you know, is an incredibly gifted prosecutor. So,
well, he and I had some fun with that case. By fun, I mean taking the wounds and interpreting them and getting it so that people could understand. So to get back to your point about the understanding and explaining things, that's my job. That's the whole point of the pathologist. If you didn't have to have somebody explain it, I mean, the technical process of going in and retrieving a bullet is not hard. In fact, in Alabama, prior to, I think, 76, they had the crime lab people were plucking bullets. That was what they considered an autopsy, was just getting the bullet out of the body. So there wasn't a whole lot of science or medicine that went in it. Anyway, so where was it? All right. So, back in Alabama, and like I think before 76, they would have the lab people, not physicians, just lab techs, do an autopsy, which was basically recovering a bullet because that's what they saw it as.
Wow.
And it's primitive and barbaric, but that's the reality of it. People don't see the need. And something that I always try to keep in mind whenever I do a case is my job is not to just do the case now. My job is to anticipate questions that somebody is going to ask 5 years from now and to be able to answer those questions. Now, I'm not God. I can't, see the future, but there are reasonable things that you can predict, like in the Smart case. What's going to be important here? Well, it's not just the fact that she was multiply injured. It was how she got injured. So then you start looking at the wounds. And after you spend some time documenting 100 different wounds, you start wondering, well, what caused those wounds? And I remember she had 3 parallel line abrasions on her back, and they were overlying her posterior or ribs on the back. And I mentioned the large grouping of injuries on the front of her chest. Well, Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is most likely right. So Occam's razor would tell us if you have injuries on the front of the chest, injuries on the back of the chest, those happened at the same time. So you start thinking of the process of how those injuries got there. Well, a compressive force would do that. What kind of compressive force? Something that pushed the chest back and caused the abrasions over the ribs at the same time.
And so in this instance, you also started to see not just the grouping, but that there was a pattern to the grouping on the chest. Is that right?
Yeah, there were. It was really interesting. So in looking, I kept seeing three circles that were separated by, well, I'd say it was about the size of the back of my hand. So about like that. And there was a circle, and a circle. And this one was kind of not as distinct as the other two. And there wasn't another circle here. So I've got basically a square with three out of the four circles at the corners. And I've got this compressive force. And I don't think it takes a rocket scientist. Well, what could compress shoes? Shoes, like being stomped on. So I turn to the detectives and I say, could you bring me the shoes from the scene? And they looked at me and sure, what do you want? Well, you know me, all of them. So they did.
Yeah, and I'm laughing because there were a lot of shoes involved in this.
Yeah, I've actually got a picture with all the shoes laid out because I then had to take each and every shoe and compare them against the pattern injuries. And, you know, I do have, by the way, I still have the trial PowerPoint that I made for this. If that's
I so wish that I had that because here's my situation. I had hoped that Jenny Parker, and you remember Jenny, sure. This was actually her case. And I second chaired it with her. And Jenny was going to be able to come on. And I gather she's been told she can't. And so all of those trial materials that I was kind of hoping I could use, talk about, refresh my memory, your memory, I don't have. And so my memory's pretty sharp about this because it is a very distinct case, but it would have been nice to have all of that.
Sure. And for me, you know, I don't remember all the specific details of all of the injuries, but I do remember, you know, a pretty good amount of the detail and the thought processes that I was going through at the time. It's a shame. I hate it when folks won't share lessons because that's how you advance, is remembering lessons from the past.
I agree, but it's not up to us to remember.
Anyway,
as far as that compression, so you get all these shoes, and how is it that you compared them to this injury on her chest?
All right, so basically do the high-tech eyeball test of I've got the measurements and I've got the shoes, and that's why I wanted the shoes then. It's just like I said a couple of times earlier, time is an asset for the investigator. Well, it's also an asset for me because as injuries exist postmortem, sometimes they recede, they become less prominent. If there's bruising into the tissue, sometimes that blood will ooze out a little more, so the patterns become less distinct. They become fuzzy at the edges. So I wanted to get the shoes, and I literally stood on a ladder over the body and would take the shoes and lay them out and, you know, do an eyeball one-to-one comparison. So I'd have a ruler and take the pictures of the bottoms of all the shoes, same ruler, take a picture of the injuries to her chest. And she also had a different pattern of circles, a couple, three, maybe four on her extremities. And you look at the shoes. So I'm looking for perhaps the same pair of shoes, but a different part, like the four. I was like, well, that's a lot of force because that was what was on the chest that actually compressed her enough to break ribs. As it happened, she also had a liver tumor, and it ripped that liver tumor and caused her to bleed extensively into her abdomen. So while she's going through all these injuries and there's no reason for her to be unconscious yet. I mean, you get the point. It's like, you start thinking about all of this, and I'm like, okay, I can see this. I hope other people can see this. So I basically have to understand, I'm going to have to explain this to a jury. And so the jury needs to be able to see what I see. And the question is how to do that. Oh, gee, I'm a geek. As you know, I am a court certified geek. Judge Barr.
Well, I don't get my board certification. I don't know how I would get to do that at this point.
All right, so twice in open court, Judge Carp referred to me as a geek. And only a geek would be proud of that.
Yes, that's true.
I'm fond of saying that I am a court-certified geek, and I appreciate the judge, and I wish him well if he's listening. Because yes. I really do enjoy that tale. I enjoyed his courtroom was always just very professional, and I really enjoyed it. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
He did try this case, and you'll probably have recalled that. This trial experience, and we're going to get to that too, was kind of an interesting one for you, as I recall.
Oh, yes, very.
Yeah, but now I'm skipping ahead. Now let's talk about...
Hey, that's all right. You can edit all of this any way you want it, right?
Yeah, here's the thing. I'm not great at editing, so I do better if I do it semi-linear at least. But I do want to talk about, you've got this injury to the chest. It's consistent with how many pairs of the shoes?
Well, it was one. And actually, here I will have to say that I was kind of puzzled initially. But I did hit on one of the pair of shoes. And I forget the company, but it was a big brand. May have a windswept look, perhaps. Don't know who that would be. Anyway, they were worn in such a way that there were four circles that are about an inch diameter on the heel, and the fellow walked in such a way that one was worn down. And our former coroner at the time, who was a retired orthopedic surgeon, was talking about the gait abnormality that causes the shoe to look like that. And so I was like, oh, well, that's fascinating. That explains, that this individual had a peculiar walk and these are his shoes. So I had the weapon. As far as I was concerned, I had something that looked pretty good for causing it. Not that I knew that it did, but it looked pretty good. And it would explain everything, particularly enough force to crush the liver and to break ribs. And there were multiple fractures. So now I've got to say, okay, I can see this. It's obvious to me, but it may not be obvious to everybody else. So what I decided to do was to create a video. And the video was basically a slow dissolve. A dissolve is where you have two pictures and you superimpose from one to the other. So we start with a picture of the wound, and there's a superimposed picture of the shoe, but you can't see it yet. And then I would gradually make it 10% transparent, 20% transparent, 30% transparent, all the way up to all you saw was the bottom of the shoe, and you didn't see the body. And I would go back and forth, toggling between those two. And it became readily apparent. It became easy. And part of the story that you may not be aware of that I thought was kind of humorous is maybe 3-4 months later, I'm at Memorial Hospital downtown. And one of the docs there I run into, and I didn't know this gentleman, but he looks at me, he says, well, I was in the cafeteria, actually. And he comes to me and says, you're Dr. Downs, right? Yes, sir. He said, well, I'm Dr. So-and-so, and I was a juror on that trial. I didn't know you then, but I want to tell you that video you showed was awesome.
He was a fantastic juror. I big thumbs up to Jenny. She is a master at getting juries. I mean, she just really has great instincts.
Well, I can tell you that I've had, this would have been the third position I've had on a jury in a trial that I was part of. One ended up in a hung jury, and one, actually both of them were hung juries because one was a physician who said he learned one day in medical school that bullets could ricochet inside the skull, so that I was wrong about the course the bullet took.
Right, right. Now, again, it is a risk always to put a professional on a jury. But her instincts were spot on this time.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's funny because, at least in what I understand, is you're not allowed to use your professional knowledge. In other words, you can't practice medicine as a juror.
Right.
So using that one day in medical school, I learned, I don't think you can actually do that, can you?
Well, it is such a hard thing when you're dealing with jury instructions. They are not allowed to go outside of, in other words, they can't Google, they can't investigate the case, but they bring to it what they bring to it. And okay. So you can't really erase their brains. You don't want to do that because then.
Sure. No. I just always thought that was peculiar because the guy was basically outside of his lane and telling me what I should have seen. Because remember, I actually tracked the bullets. I knew what it did.
Right. And again, like I said, you know, having a professional on there is a gamble. In this case, it was a good gamble. And I think it was, and we've only scratched the surface really, as far as her injuries go, but they were so overwhelming that it wasn't a situation where I was concerned about it. And I know that that's always a concern for you as well, is that, you know, are you getting into one of these battle of the experts with somebody who's just a juror, as opposed to, at least with an expert, you get to talk, you get to respond to their thought process, which you don't have jurors. But again, it ended up being a good thing here. So the injuries, you see this, and that video, I think, just made it so incredibly clear. To the jurors, to me, to, you know, everybody who was there, what happened to Lauren. But the extent of not just the external injuries, but her internal injuries was profound, in my opinion. What was it? You talked about, like, she bled a lot internally. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't remember the precise quantity, but I believe it was something like a liter of blood. Adult female has 5, maybe 6 liters of blood. So you lose 20% of your blood volume. Again, that speaks to what she experienced and the consciousness during the process.
So she was conscious for at least some of it.
Yes. I can't tell you how much, and I can't tell you what part, but I believe she was, yes.
And the level, and you talked about, and I remember there was something like, if I remember, like 80 some odd internal injuries, you know, just lacerations to the liver and the kidneys and, you know, just so many things. And if I remember it, there was damage to her aorta. Is that right? Do I have that right?
I believe there may have been a tear to the right atrium of her heart.
Okay.
And the reason that is, and I actually learned this from one of my mentors, Roy Riddick, down in Mobile, who has since passed away, unfortunately. He was one of the great ones. But he had noted in the association, when you forcefully compress the liver, we see that injury a lot in car wrecks. When you're thrown into the dashboard, you forcefully compress the liver, you shoot a column of blood into the heart, into the right atrium of the heart, and that column of blood has nowhere to go, so it tries to tear the point of least resistance, and that point is the within the right atrium of the heart.
Wow.
So again, combining knowledge from multiple areas of medicine together, Occam's razor. What's the simplest explanation for this?
Right. And I remember you testified that the level of injury she sustained was like a car wreck.
Yeah, I would say that that's a fair assessment. This was a lot of injuries. And the thing is, none of them in isolation would be, I guess, extreme. It was the totality of all of these moderate to low level. I mean, some of them were bruises to the arm. I wouldn't call that a dramatic injury. It's going to be painful, but it was this constellation of, you know, 100 different injuries all together, multiple bone numerous injuries.
And most of her injuries, if I remember right, were fresh. There were a few that had aged.
She may have had a couple of injuries that were not fresh, but again, that would speak to perhaps her alcohol use and perhaps to having been beaten in the past.
Right.
And I believe, if memory serves, there was a history of that was uncovered by the primary investigators. And again, that's another part that a lot of people don't understand. I don't get the whole story.
Right.
I get part of the story. And I don't get the whole investigation. I get part of the investigation. So I have a, I plug into a certain component of this. I think it's an important component, but I don't have all the answers. And, you know, sometimes people ask me about trials that are on TV and stuff like that. And I tell them, look, I haven't seen the whole story. I don't know.
Right. Right. And I think that that's really true. And unless you get a chance to really sit down with, and, you know, people ask us about like investigations or, you know, things you see on TV all the time. And I am not going to give an opinion about something when I don't know everything or know enough to have an educated opinion. But in this
Well, my favorite example of that is the Aaron Hernandez case.
Yeah.
You know, I worked on the case for the defense and was able to prove conclusively that he couldn't possibly have fired the shots into the vehicle with the two people in it. Now, you might have seen a certain Netflix show that
I don't watch this.
Saying I haven't watched it either because I was basically laughing at the absurdity of what they presented too much. But let's just say that people get certain things in their mind and they run with it. And that's a really good example. Like the detectives who investigated that case were absolutely convinced that he had done it. They didn't bother to look at the could he have because he had done it. They didn't need to look at that. They knew he did it.
Well, and again, I think that that's part of the advantage of someone like you. And you talked about you didn't have the whole story. You didn't have the whole investigation. But that it takes that confirmation bias out of it.
Yeah.
Scientifically, you need to look at what's there.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I try to do is I look at a case and I say, okay, why am I wrong here? Which is, you know, that's most people don't approach their work like that. But that's when I finish something. Why am I wrong? Why did I get this wrong? And the reason I do that is if someone else is right, if the defense is right in whatever their person is saying, then I have to be wrong. So right. What about what I'm saying that's wrong? Let me find that.
Right.
And
that was because there were suggestions we talked about. You know, did she die from anorexia?
No.
Did she die from the liver tumor?
Only in the sense that it was a fertile ground for it to tear the liver when she was stomped.
And you know, there, because there was a suggestion she had a liver tumor, it was going to kill her. I think you had actually examined it. It was benign, right?
Yeah, as I recall, because tumors are not all malignant. Tumor is just a swelling. It was a large tumor, and it probably eventually would have needed surgery, almost certainly. But she wasn't experiencing any symptoms. I don't believe she knew about it. And, you know, here's the thing. A homicide is a homicide. You don't get to pick your victim. You take your victim as you get them. And if they happen to have a liver tumor, well, you know, you picked the wrong person to kill.
Right. There were also, and I think that they had brought you, in addition to the gun that was found, that they thought there was a pistol whipping injury.
Yeah, that was actually very interesting. It was right near the three rib injuries on the back, and I've seen a lot of pistol whippings. I didn't see anything, but there was a circular area, and it was really easy because the pistol had a circular area on it. So now I can look at only the circular areas on the weapon and compare those circular areas with the weapon on the wound on the body. And the logo of the company that made that particular firearm was in the circle, and that wasn't represented in the pattern on the body. So I was pretty quickly able to say, no, it's not that.
And you actually have written several articles on pistol whipping injuries, if I remember correctly.
Again, it's a pattern injury. So yeah, I would include that in pattern injury stuff I've written on.
You and I had a case that had pistol whipping injuries, as I recall.
Sure, we have. We did.
But in this case, there was also, I lost my train of thought. But thinking about it, when you testified, the setup of the courtroom was abnormal for what we normally try to do. And you had this very extensive PowerPoint, and we had to kind of cram all this equipment in because this is a very small space. But the defendant didn't like you, as I recall.
Well, I can't imagine that anybody would. I mean, that's just goes without saying. I just say, don't shoot the messenger. I'm just telling you what I see.
Yeah. And I remember you telling me at the time, because we had to take a recess during your testimony. And I don't know if you remember this at all, but he started yelling at you.
Actually, I remember it. He started approaching the bench and yelling at me that I got it wrong. Right. I got it wrong as he was advancing to me. And I people don't understand this. I didn't pay him any attention. Because to me, the defendant is unimportant in a case. I'm not there testifying against anybody. I'm not testifying for anybody. This is what I saw. And, I don't look at the defendant. I look at the jury. Because those are the people that I am there to explain something to. So I just remember when he did that, out of my peripheral, I could see that he was being, other people were coming to restrain him, and then they escorted him to the courtroom. But, I'm sure he got angry. I'm sure that he didn't like what I was saying. And, again, the truth is the truth.
Right. I know that we have, I feel like we haven't done justice to this at all as far as, the work that you did here. What would you want people to take away from this?
Gosh, there's so many different ways you can break things down. I'd say first and foremost is domestic violence isn't a solution to anything. Nor is if you're in a bad situation turning to alcohol or drugs or whatever other thing as an escape, because it's not an escape. It actually will tend to keep you in a bad situation. If you need to get help, help is available. Make a call. There are women's shelters and places that you can go to get help if you find yourself in a bad place. If you get angry with someone, take a minute and really think about it. Is it worth whatever the outcome is going to be, which may not be to your liking? Or can you just chill for a while? You can always step out the door and walk off and cool off. So those, I think, would be my big things for society at large. For investigators, I would say, take your time and consider what the magnitude of what you're doing and how important it is.
Well, how easy would it have been to just completely overlook what happened here?
Well, it wouldn't.
Didn't you?
Well, I mean, it's really easy to just document the wounds. You know, I've been telling you the job as though that's what everybody does, because I would hope that that is what everybody does. The reality is probably that most people wouldn't have made the effort that I did. I didn't get paid anything extra for doing PowerPoints or videos, but you know, my job is I'm a physician first, but my obligation is to my patient. And my patient may be deceased, but I'm there to try to tell their story as best I can. To remember that, and what I try to remember and I tell people is, look, the family has lost somebody. They're never coming back. And immediately, their loved one is replaced by me in their lives. Right? And how they interact with me, the autopsy report, that's going to reflect on them anytime they think about their loved one, good or bad. And I mean, I've had people that don't really care for what I have to say. This wasn't the first time, it won't be the last. But to understand that people are coming from a place that to them is very painful, and they want answers. And sometimes I can give them answers, sometimes I can't. But to always know that I'm trying the best I can, and I'm not perfect, I'm human. But I am going to try for you. And at the end of the day, I think that every forensic pathologist ought to step up to the plate and do the best they can. Yeah, it takes a little more time, but you know what? You're a physician first.
And again, you know, these cases, and this is not your first, it's not your last. They're heartbreaking. They just are.
They could be if you allowed yourself that luxury.
Right.
I don't, because that doesn't have any place in what I do. So I don't really, I have to dissociate the person from what happens, which may seem cold and callous, but if you kept the demons of every case that you ever did, all the horrible things, there's so many horrible things I've seen in my life that I wish I had never seen and wish I could not have seen. But you know what? I can process the information and handle it. It takes a certain kind of weird personality to do that. To just step back and look at it clinically. But the way I look at it is I am a person of faith, and I believe that God gave me a mission, something to do. He blessed me with an ability to see things that perhaps other people can't see, and then to explain that to them and to show them what I can see. And it helps to me that, according to the tenets of my faith, that person isn't there anymore. What you're looking at, it's like, and it's a bad analogy, but it's the best I've ever been able to come up with. It's like a bottle of wine. What made that bottle of wine interesting to a lot of people was what was in it. It's not the shell. And, you know, the bottle here, the body is empty, but the good part's still there and still exists. And you honor that part by doing the very best you can and recognizing that you'll fall short of perfection because we're human. But just because you know that we all fall short doesn't mean you try any less hard to achieve perfection.
Right. I'm 100% with you on all of that. And I'm so grateful that you're willing to share this time with me. I'm hoping that I'll be able to address some other cases that we've worked on, the murder of Jennifer Ross at some point. And some of the other cases that I know that you've worked on.
Jennifer Ross, I remember that one well, because the detectives were telling me I got it all wrong.
As they do. And you know, it is a fascinating thing. And I think actually there was a battle of the experts almost on the state side in that case. But that
really?
It's a story for another day. But
fascinating.
Not entirely. The emergency physicians that treated her there was a little bit of conflict between exactly how they thought the bleed out happened.
I seem to remember that. That would be an interesting case. And actually, the one that became a movie, Alice Is Still Dead.
Oh, yes. That was Thunderbolt. That was Jerry's.
Yeah.
I would love to do that, Jerry.
I'm in contact with the brother. Right. He and I are Facebook friends, and actually he wants to do a movie.
He's already done. I think he's filmed something.
He wants to do another movie with me.
Oh, wow. That'd be cool.
He said, you've got some interesting stories. And I'm like, well, yeah, I guess.
You've seen some things. And, you know, anyone who has touched on this part of the universe has seen some things that are sad and compelling, and you know how it is that you do what you do, the scientific element of it, is something that people struggle to understand, and I think it's really important to get that out.
Well, I'll give you a way that other people may connect with something I had never done before. I went on a medical mission trip to the Dominican Republic.
Right, just last year.
Yeah, and I went to a third world country where people were living in shacks with tin roofs with big holes in it, and they didn't have anything, and yet the people generally were happy with nothing. And we were able to come with limited medications, and it's the starfish story. You look at this giant bucket of all the poverty and all the sick people, and you go, we can't possibly make a difference. And yet you still go and you still try, and you see horrible things. You see people in poverty and sick. And just a couple of cases that I saw in particular really broke my heart. But I can't let the being heartbroken stop the good from happening. And to set the example, if nothing else, of trying. Because as I've said so many times before, if you don't try, you're guaranteed to fail. In fact, you already have.
Yeah. And it can be overwhelming. And I appreciate you because I know what you're doing. And I know that you are still trying every day. And that is a huge thing.
Well, that's all we can do is try, and one starfish at a time.
I am so grateful to have had the opportunity to work with someone who has Dr. Down's level of expertise, especially on a case that had this level of medical complexity. I'd never heard Dr. Downs use the term overkill before or since this case in a trial, and it made headlines. He is a man with stories to tell, and I plan to have him on again soon. In our next episode, I get the opportunity to remind our audience that Lauren Brown was a real, breathing part of a family who loved and cared for her. Lauren's father, Barry Brown, sat down with me and former District Attorney Meg Heap last year, and he has given me the permission to publish that interview here. This interview will also take some time to edit, but reveals how domestic violence has ripple effects that extend far beyond any statistics or dry recitation of evidence can describe. Join us.